CGM 99.1 FM programming is hosted almost exclusively by community volunteers. The views and opinions expressed on the following program are that of the host and their guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of CGM FM. For more information and resources, visit our website at cjam.ca.
Hi, I'm Samantha, a past guest on CGM's Handy Link. You're listening to Handy Link on CGM 99.1 FM, reaching high ground in Windsor, Detroit.
Welcome to Handy Link, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that provides recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex. For more information, check out ICHA Windsor on Facebook. I'm your host, Cam Wells.
In this segment of our show, Angel Bernard will be telling us about the Huntington Society. So what can you tell me about the Huntington Society?
So the Huntington Society actually is celebrating their 50th anniversary this year. They were created back in 1973 by Ralph and Ariel Walker, who felt there was a gap and there weren't any services for individuals and families affected by Huntington disease. And so they started this organization at their kitchen table. And they connected with families directly. They took their family out across the country over the summer months and connected with families across Canada. And so that's how they started the Huntington Society of Canada. And since then, we've developed into a little bit of a bigger organization. And now as an organization, we have social workers from Vancouver all the way to St. John's, Newfoundland.
So in that sense, how does Huntington typically affect a person?
So Huntington disease is a neurodegenerative disease, and it is genetic, and so it runs in family. So in families where the parent has Huntington disease, each one of the children have a 50-50 risk of inheriting the gene mutation that will lead to Huntington disease. Huntington disease is an adult onset disease, and so it affects mainly the brain. It does affect other parts of the body, but mainly the brain. And so through that, it affects the way a person thinks, the way a person feels, and the way a person moves with involuntary movements that are called chorea, and issues such as speech issues, swallowing issues. And as the disease progresses, the person's ability to do things and take care of themselves are affected. And usually the disease will span over 15 to 20 years once the symptoms have started. There is a juvenile form of the disease, which is much more rare. It only happens in about 10% of the Huntington disease cases, but it does affect children under the age of 18. And then there's also a late onset version of the disease, which affects older adults after the age of 60. And that also is a rarer form of the disease and also affects about 10% of our population.
So how does the society go about reaching out to those affected?
So we are a voluntary service, and so we do promote our services. We have an online presence. We also have different campaigns where we try to reach out to different community members. We have different newsletters that we send out where people can sign up for some of our newsletters that provide education, that provide stories about community members, that provide information about the disease. We also have, as I mentioned, social workers on the ground in different regions, and so they connect directly with service providers, healthcare services, with the families themselves, and so to help support the families as they move through the different phases of Huntington disease, whether it's at the beginning, which could be through the predictive genetic testing process, or it could be as the disease moves forward, as they connect with the clinics that help support them with neurologists and psychiatrists, and also all the way to the end of life when people are facing the last phases of Huntington disease itself. The social workers also provide education to those care facilities and healthcare services. And then we also have another arm at the organization, which are chapters, which are volunteers. And in those chapters, those volunteers also help to raise awareness about the disease within their communities and their regions. And they also help to organize and put on events that bring people together for fundraising activities, but also for social connections, as I mentioned, and raising awareness about the disease itself. So, one of the big pieces the chapters take on is our annual Amaryllis campaign. And so every fall we have Amaryllis bulbs that we sell as part of our national fundraiser. And these beautiful Amaryllis really grow across the country, which is kind of neat to see. So our chapters, our volunteers are also very important to our community.
So in your time with the society, has there been any success story that stands out for you?
I think with the society, so I've been with the society since 2008, and so I've seen a few things in my time with the families. I think the success can be defined in different ways, and so for me, a success could be when a family feels like they've been heard and feel like they've connected with another group of people that have a similar lived experience and just get what it is that they're living with. That sense of connection is a success. I also think that when we meet with service providers or with community members and they're just learning about Huntington disease, and you kind of see that light bulb moment where they go, oh, so that's Huntington disease and that's what that is. And so that's a success in itself. I also think we have some wonderful programs through our organization, and one of them being our young youth and young adult mentorship program that we've created and is almost 10 years old, where we connect youth and young adults from our HD community. They're trained mentors, and they connect with other youth from families affected by HD, and they can build a relationship with someone who understands what it's like to be from a family with Huntington disease. So really reducing that sense of isolation, reducing that sense of nobody gets what I'm going through. And so building those connections, building those links for people, I think is another success of what we do with the Huntington Society.
So do you know offhand about how many people are affected by Huntington?
So the statistics in Canada say that about 1 in 7,000 people have Huntington disease. 1 in 5,500 is at risk. And so it is considered a rare disorder. But another statistic that we share is that 1 in 1,000 people will know someone who's affected by HD, whether it's someone through your workplace, someone through your social circles, someone in your neighborhood. And so people may encounter someone with Huntington disease without necessarily understanding what that person is living.
Like, thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Sounds good.
In this segment of our show, Paula Eckford will be telling us about Cystic Fibrosis Canada. So what can you tell me about CF Canada?
So Cystic Fibrosis Canada was formed in 1960 from some parents who had children with CF and obviously were looking for some way to help. The organization has been in existence since then, and we started funding research in about 1962. And now we've sort of expanded our role into multiple different areas. So we fund research. We provide some funding to the 40 CF clinics across Canada. We have a patient data registry that tracks the data on people with CF in Canada. We have a clinical trials network that's involved in bringing clinical trials for new treatments to Canadians with CF. And we also have an advocacy portfolio that works to help provide supports and improve the lives of people with CF. So we've invested about $200 million into cystic fibrosis research since 1962 when we started. And we've made some really, or we've supported some really big developments in the research space. So we've supported research towards improving the nutrition of people with CF. The discovery of the gene was done at SickKids in Toronto, partly with the support of Cystic Fibrosis Canada. And we've really been there all along the way with CF patients.
So for those who might not be as familiar, what are some of the most common impacts of CF?
Yeah, so cystic fibrosis is it's an inherited genetic disease. So you need to have two mutations, one from the mother and one from the father. And when you have that, you develop cystic fibrosis. And so some of the characteristics of the disease are difficulties with nutrition. So poor nutrition is one factor that shows up early on. And there are challenges with many of the surfaces of organs and tissues in the body. The most well-known is the lung defect with cystic fibrosis. So in patients with cystic fibrosis, there's a defect in hydration of the surface of the lungs. The lungs are normally sort of a moist environment, and you get mucus in the lungs, and it sort of moves along this moist surface and gets cleared very easily. In cystic fibrosis, the surface becomes much more dry. The mucus gets drier, thick, and very sticky, and it sticks to the surface and doesn't clear well. Then you get frequent infections in that mucus that sort of sits there and doesn't get cleared. And that starts to cause damage to the lungs. And so CF patients experience these recurrent severe infections, and it results in inflammation and damage to the lungs. And it's primarily the lung defect that causes morbidity and mortality for people with CF.
So, do you know offhand about how many people are impacted by the condition?
Yeah, so there are just over 4,300 Canadians alive with cystic fibrosis right now. It occurs in about 1 in 3,600 live births in Canada right now.
So, in your time with CF Canada, has there been any success story that stands out for you?
So the biggest success in the disease so far was the advent of what we call highly effective modulator treatments. And the most well-known is a drug called Trikafta. And really the development of Trikafta has been an absolute game changer for some patients with cystic fibrosis. And it really developed out of the work that started with the discovery of the gene, and then sort of we built our understanding of the defects in the disease and ultimately learned that we could treat using small molecule drugs to improve how the protein that's defective in this disease functions. So Trikafta is a combination of small molecules in the form of a drug. It's a pill that people take daily, and it's intended for people with the most common mutation in CF, which is about 87% of the Canadian population. And it's absolutely been a life-changing drug for many people. So it helps to improve the surface hydration because it helps restore the normal function of the protein that's defective. And so your patients are able to clear their mucus from their lungs. And many patients, as they go on this, within the first few days, end up coughing up a lot of material and suddenly are able to breathe much better. And there are also other impacts outside of the lungs. So Trikafta has been an absolute game changer. One of the biggest challenges for the organization is through our advocacy efforts, because it's quite an expensive drug. And so there's needed to be a lot of work to advocate for inclusion of this drug on provincial drug reimbursement plans, and ensure that the deductibles aren't too high to be a burden for CF patients. And it's ongoing work. So all of the provinces and territories do fund this drug in some way now. For many, the deductibles are still too high on those programs, and so we're working hard to improve that. But really, Trikafta has been an absolute game changer for many people. However, there's two groups I'd just like to touch on very briefly. There are some people with some rare mutations where we know that they could benefit from this drug. However, it's only been approved for the most common mutation. So right now, there are about 200 people in Canada, or just over 200 people, who don't have access to this drug, even though we know that it could be very beneficial for them. And a few of those people have been in the news recently, for example, with very poor lung health and striving to get access to this drug that they feel would be life-changing for them. And right now, there's no pathway for those people. So we're working hard trying to advocate on their behalf. But it's slow going, and it's going to take some time, but we're hopeful we'll get there. And then there's another group of patients where they have very rare mutations that won't benefit from this drug. And so we need to continue to work to find new therapies for those individuals as well.
Like, thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Absolutely. Thanks.
HandyLink will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
The Sexual Wellness and Consent Committee at the University of Windsor is dedicated to creating a community that is well-informed of sexual violence and well-being. Through campaigns and workshops, we offer resources, tools, and education to victims and witnesses of sexual violence and are committed to creating a safe and supportive space within the UWindsor community. Connect with the Sexual Wellness and Consent Committee online to access our podcast, partake in activities, and learn more about self-care and wellness. Find us on Instagram at WeCare@UW or on Facebook at FlipTheScriptUWindsor to learn more about our campaigns.
Welcome back to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that provides recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex. For more information, check out ICHA Windsor on Facebook. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, Angèle Bernard told us a little bit about Huntington, and Paul Eckford told us about Cystic Fibrosis Canada.
In this segment of our show, Nathan Peck will be telling us about Cure VCP.
So what can you tell me about Cure VCP?
Sure. Yeah, so my mother is deceased from the disease. My aunt is deceased from the disease. I have an uncle that passed away last year from it, and another uncle with the disease. And so four out of my mom's six siblings, or four out of the six, got the VCP gene mutation, and VCP stands for valacin-containing protein. It's also called the P97 gene, and so the mutation causes multiple different diseases, and actually the official, we call it VCP disease, which is short for VCP-associated multisystem proteinopathy, which is a mouthful, and patients can get several different diseases. About 90% of patients get inclusion body myopathy, which is muscle wasting, muscle weakness, which is what I have. My mother also had it. About 50% of patients can develop Paget's disease of bone, which is a skeletal disease that could cause your skull to get bigger, but also a lot of bone pain, brittle bones. 40% of patients will develop frontal temporal dementia, which is actually the disease that Bruce Willis's family just announced, which is not a memory dementia, but a behavior dementia. And then some patients can develop ALS from the gene mutation. Some patients can develop Charcot-Marie-Tooth. Some patients can develop Parkinsonisms. And so it's not mutually exclusive. You can develop one, two, three, or four of these different diseases. My family is usually just exhibited inclusion body myopathy as well as Paget disease of bone. So it's adult onset and autosomal dominant, meaning that if a parent's a carrier, it's 50-50 that your offspring can get it. So it doesn't, you know, you don't see generation skipping with like recessive diseases. It's just 50-50. And so I knew growing up that I had a 50% chance. We had a curse in the family, and I had a 50% chance of getting whatever this mystery disease was. So hopefully that helps in terms of a little bit of information about the disease.
So in that sense, with all the comorbidities, is there ever a risk with the gene mutation itself that it would be misdiagnosed as something else?
Absolutely, yeah. So my mom was misdiagnosed first with facioscapular muscular dystrophy. She was then misdiagnosed with limb-girdle muscular dystrophy. And Cam, if you saw me walking, which I can still walk, I'm still ambulatory, you would think I have limb-girdle muscular dystrophy. A lot of our patients are misdiagnosed with inclusion body myositis or multiple sclerosis. A lot of the symptoms resemble MS. So, yes, it's very common, you know, because my family researched years ago. We knew the researcher. I didn't go through the misdiagnosis journey that others did, other family members did, which kind of paved the way for us. But a lot of patients in our patient population, yes, go through that misdiagnosis journey, which they say the average is 7 years. So
how do you reach out to those affected and provide supports for those with this disease, or this group of diseases, rather?
So it's hard. From the patient standpoint, most patients end up coming to us because the only conclusive way to diagnose the gene mutation is to have a genetic test. So once they have that genetic test, the VCP gene mutation, on some of the gene panels, we're listed as a resource, but usually it's their doctor that will provide that information or an internet search. And that's why we've done a lot in terms of social media as well as SEO, you know, on Google, that when you search VCP, we pop up at the top. And so what we do to support is really the education and awareness, because the patient ultimately is going to know more than probably their doctor does about this condition. And up until 2 years ago, we had no standard of care for how to treat the disease. So a lot of patients would go to their doctor and the doctor didn't know what to do with them, didn't know what maybe diagnostic tools or therapy. You know, there are no therapies, there's no treatments except for Paget disease of bone. And so getting a nuclear bone scan. But, you know, we published with a consortium of 50 different clinicians, got consensus, and put together a standard of care, which was the first ever piece of literature that existed to help patients. But we do monthly happy hours so that patients know they're not alone. So we do try to provide some support services just to bring people together, because there are a lot of different manifestations. Everybody's at different ages in the disease. But yeah, it's, you know, and just driving the scientific community as well. I mean, that's a lot of the work that we do.
So do you know offhand about how many people are affected by VCP?
Yeah, so the prevalence, the literature, the published literature estimates 0.066 per 100,000, which for the U.S. population, that would be about 250 people. We know that's light. And back to your misdiagnosis question, because we know people are misdiagnosed. We also know, especially in the FTD population, that people are not getting genetically tested. And so they're either diagnosed with Alzheimer's or dementia, and they're not getting, or misdiagnosed, you know, from FTD, but they're not getting that genetic testing. And so we've started to identify families now that FTD is the only symptom or phenotype, but it wasn't until they were genetically tested that they were identified. And so that's why in those communities, we're really trying, you know, we work with the partner organizations to make them aware of VCP. We would estimate globally probably less than 2,000.
So,
but that's why I do some work with Indo-US Rare and other organizations globally, because we know genetic testing is not happening there, and it may be more than 2,000.
So do you have any advice for anyone out there who might be concerned that they might have this, that they're someone who just doesn't have a proper diagnosis? Are there any steps they can take to get better educated?
Yeah, I think the challenge, usually the first symptom that presents is the muscle weakness, the inclusion biomyopathy. So that's why a lot of them are, well, who end up being patients, go to a neurologist or a neuromuscular doctor in the beginning. But again, the genetic testing is going to be the only conclusive way. My caveat on that is don't just go get genetically tested right away, and you certainly need to work with a genetic counseling professional or a doctor on that, because there are a lot of financial implications to knowing if you were to test positive, you know, life insurance, disability insurance. Once you know that you might have a terminal, for lack of a better word, a terminal kind of rare disease, those options are off the table. So medical insurance, you can't be discriminated against because of the Affordable Care Act and the GINA Act. But life insurance and disability insurance, you absolutely can. And so like my kids, the doctor's like, oh, we need to test your kids. No, no way. You know, first of all, they don't need to know because it's an adult onset disease. And secondly, there's a lot of financial ramifications. So for people that think they may have something and even adjacent diseases or symptoms, just be very thoughtful and work with a professional before you just go get genetically tested.
Like, thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Sure.
My friends, one of the scariest and most difficult things in disability life can be improper diagnosis. While so many conditions can resemble one another, a doctor may not be versed in every variety of every condition. That's where it's incumbent upon each one of us to be our own best advocates. We don't want to end up with something that will only treat one or two of the symptoms and worsen the overall problem. Fact is, we know our responses, we know ourselves. If something's not right, talk about it. Be open and honest with your doctor about your condition. The fact of the matter is, there's no sense living in shame or stigma about any condition, really. But the fact is, a disability is just like any other facet of life. It's a tool. How you choose to work with it depends on you. I mean, why is it we place these clouds and these myths and these stereotypes around the idea of a disability anyway? It's not evil, it's not a curse, it's not something that makes a person weak by any stretch of the imagination. Being open and honest about one's own situation can be a source of strength unto itself. The fact is, once you realize you're not facing it alone, and supports do exist, you can start to make progress, start to live a more full, active life. I maintain there's hope for anybody. We don't need to live by anyone else's definition of a full life. We just need to acknowledge and understand the things we want to accomplish for ourselves, and stand by others in their journey as they try to build something meaningful in their lives. Fact is, a person with a disability is a unique person. They have hopes, dreams, goals, all their own. And it is not anybody's place to say you are greater than or you are less than because of this one factor. This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you we're all equal, so So get on out there and have yourselves a good one. Something tells me you've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.